Thank everybody for coming tonight. It certainly means a great deal to me, and it means a great deal to Gilad's family. And I just wanted, as a couple remarks of introduction, just wanted to reflect on a thought that I had about Gilad that I wanted to speak about tonight. A lot of people, especially, I guess, not this time of year, but when the Shear starts to take notice and we start having flyers and we try to honor his memory and his legacy, people start asking me that don't know him, because a lot of people here that I see definitely do know Gilad, but a lot of people here certainly don't as well. And just recently, someone asked me, they said, you know, what was so special about Gilad? What made him so unique? And it's a tough question to answer. You know, a lot of people have a lot of different attributes that are really important, and it's always difficult to specifically isolate on one that makes someone specifically and incredibly unique. But I think what a lot of people liked about Gilad, and what I still remember a lot, is that he was just very comfortable being himself. And especially in high school, which is where Gilad's years unfortunately ended, and he wasn't really, I mean, he was in college for a little bit, but just a very difficult time to not be swayed and persuaded and just completely impacted by your surroundings. And it's a difficult time to really create a sense of self. And what's, you know, so special about being around someone who's comfortable in their own skin is it really unconsciously gives you permission to be yourself. And it's not something that's in your face. It doesn't say to you like, oh, this is exactly how you should be, or this is the things that you should be doing. But when you speak to someone and you really understand them and you feel that they really have a real sense of fire, a real sense of energy, a real sense of authenticity, it's something you really just don't forget. And it's something that's incredibly special, and it's something that I really miss a lot. And I'm sure a lot of people here also certainly do. A lot of people were really helpful in making this happen tonight. I just wanted to a few thank yous. Can't thank everybody, but Margot Reinstein, Adam Simulover, Street Rothschild, Alex Porcelain were really helpful in helping with the Facebook group, and a lot of other things setting this up. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Schachter, who's speaking here for the third time. We really can't thank him enough for agreeing to speak. It's I feel indebted to him for helping perpetuate his legacy, and without further ado.
Bershus, members of Gilad's family who are here. And with Hakar Satov to Adam for everything that he continues to do to perpetuate Gilad's memory. I stand before you now for the third year in a row to deliver a shiur, Li'ili Nishmas Gilad Hillel ben Eliyahu Mordechai Ubracha Miro. I want to begin by reflecting for a moment on Me'inyana D'Yoma, Rishus Rabbi Blau, who honors us with his presence. There are a number of halachos in Sfiras HaOmer that I think are relevant to Gilad's life and to Gilad's legacy, the way I understand it from Adam over the course of these few years. And how I remember with such depth the words of Gilad's mother that she has shared with us over these years. One halach in Sfira Sa'omer is Sfira Shetei Sfira L'Chalechot V'Yechot. Shetei Sfira L'Chalechot V'Yechot means that it's a whole question about Shemeya Ka'one, you make the bracha, I listen, I'm Yotzei. But when it comes to counting the Omer, everybody has to count for themselves. He was a young man who was tragically taken from us as a young man who stood up for himself and who represented himself and who had a strong identity of self and left an incredible impact on people with whom he came into contact. Kalechot v'yachot means that I'm going to do it, and I'm not going to depend on anybody else to do it. And then there are two halachas that are related to one another. One is b'kol ram, and one is ba'amida. There's a special halacha that's Sfir Sa'omer, the counting has to be done standing, and it should be done out loud. And both of them bespeak a certain self-confidence and a sense of self that Adam just spoke about, that Gilad had, that he was proud of who he was comfortable with whom he was, and he projected that to others. And he represented his identity, ba'amida and b'kol ram. And everything that was important to him was ba'amida and b'kol ram. And finally, there's a Mishnah in Sota about the various languages that we may or may not use for various ritual purposes. And the halach is that Sfir Sa'omer should be done b'lashon HaKodesh. We shouldn't say it in English, or we shouldn't say it in any other language, but we should say it in Hebrew, in the holy tongue. And for me, Lashon HaKodesh represents a certain authenticity, an authenticity of tradition, and an authenticity of an individual. Not to be something else that we think we should be, or others think that we should be, but to be comfortable with who we are, and to be authentic to ourselves, and to represent a tradition, to represent a national tradition, to represent a family tradition, and to represent it authentically and meaningfully, without any compromise. And so I think all of these aspects, Shetei Sfira L'Chalecha V'Yechad, Amida and Kol Ram, and Lashon HaKodesh, are relevant to all of us, not only in terms of the halachas of Sfira Sa'omer, but seem to me to stand out as hallmarks of Gilad's life and characteristics that would be important for us all to emulate ourselves going forward. It's not Judaism by proxy. It's not somebody else is going to do it, but we have to do it. It's not somebody else is going to do the chesed, but we have to do the chesed. It's not somebody else is going to go to Minyan, but we have to go to Minyan. It's not that somebody else is going to learn Torah, but we have to learn Torah. And we have to represent our Jewish identities proudly. And we have to represent them authentically. And as you, as students, now grow up and enter into the mainstream of the Jewish community, these are important things for you to keep in mind. I want to devote this evening to a subject that I've been thinking about the last couple of months. And that has to do with the halachic status of printing and the notion of the impact of technology on our ritual lives. I started to think about it last summer when I was invited to speak, and the assignment was think about developing an ethic of the internet. So we all use the internet. There was a lot of discussion in the community a couple of months ago. There was an asifa against the internet. We all use the internet. That's part of our lives. That's the reality. And the internet is a bracha, and the internet also poses challenges. And I have yet to see a carefully worded, reasoned, sophisticated analysis in print on coming up with a way of understanding what this is, because it's here to stay, what this is, both in terms of the blessings, as well as how to deal with some of the challenges. So what are the challenges, and what are ways of dealing with these challenges to come up with an ethic, a fundamental ethic of understanding the internet and the reality of the internet. And to prepare this presentation, I realized very soon that one need not reinvent the wheel. That in a sense, issues that were raised with printing, when printing was first invented, are exactly similar to the issues that we face today when it comes to the internet. Now obviously it's magnified many, many times in the case of the internet, but essentially the issues are the same. And I began to analyze the discussions that took place in the community in the primarily 16th century when printing became more popular, the first Hebrew printed book was at the end of the 15th century. The first Hebrew printed book ever was the Perush of Rashi El HaTorah, which is actually extraordinary when you think about it. It's not the Chumash. It's not a Gemara. It's Perush Rashi El HaTorah. It was printed as a separate volume, the first Hebrew book ever printed in Jewish history. And there were a couple of hundred by the end of the 15th century, and in the 16th century begins to take off, and it arouses a lot of interest, and it arouses a lot of controversy. In the course of that analysis, I came across something that struck me as really, to me, very interesting, that I would like to share with you, and to share it with you this evening in memory of Gilad Hillel ben Eliyahu Mordechai Ubracha Miro. I want to start with the Gemara Masechet Sota, page 2. Does anybody need a copy of the sheets? Anybody not have a handout? We're going to be learning off the handouts. We're going to learn a Gemara Masechet Sota, the very end of Masechet Sota, Daf Mem Ches Amid Beis. The issue that the Gemara here is dealing with is how did the names of the Shvatim get onto the stones that made up the Choshen and the Ephod. So we know that the Kohen Gadol had Big Day Kahuna, and one of the Big Day Kahuna was the Choshen. It was a breastplate, it had 12 stones, and each one had a name of a Shevet on the stone. And then there was an Ephod, and there were stones on the Ephod by the shoulder, and each one had 6 names. And the question that the Gemara is trying to figure out is, how did the names of the Shvatim get, and I'm using this word advisedly, how did they get onto the stones? Says the Gemara, Mibaya Leila Chidasanya, on page 2. Mibaya Leila Chidasanya. There's an arrow in the margin of the Gemara. Avonim Halolu, Ein Kosfen Osan Bidyo. So the obvious option is, you take a quill and you take ink, and you put the quill in the ink, and then you write the names of the Shvatim on the stones. Says the Gemara, that's not an option. Mishum shenemar pituchei chosam. Because the Torah says they have to be inscribed, that the names have to be inscribed. If you just write them, then it stays on the surface, and it doesn't get inscribed, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. Nu, so then the option is, so inscribe them. How do you inscribe something on stone? You take a little thin zachala, a little thing with a little thin end, you take a little hammer roll, and you are gifted, and then you go and you chisel around a little bit on the stone, and you inscribe a letter on the stone, and if you know what you're doing, it looks pretty okay, and one letter after another, and spells a word, and so on. Says the Gemara, no option. Also not an option. Vein mesartin eilam bi zemel, and you can't etch it with a cutting tool. Mishum shenemar bi miluosam, because the Torah says they have to be complete. The stones have to be complete. What's the problem? If you start chiseling away in order to create the groove, in order to create the letter, then that little bit of stone that is being removed in order to create the groove is being lost. And it's a chisaron in the kiyum of b'miluosam. So the Gemara says, what am I going to do? I can't write on it, and I can't scratch it out, because I have psukim that preclude either one of those two options. And for the Gemara, l'kosev alem b'diyo, here's what we did. So you take the ink and you outline the letters on the stone with the ink. And then, umareh lohen shamir mibachutz. What's the shamir? Anybody know what the shamir was? A worm. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I don't know what this is. There was, what about the worm? What did the worm do? What?
It ate stone.
It ate stone. Did it eat stone or it separated stone? So how did they cut the various stones that they needed in the Midbar and in the Beis HaMikdash? They had a magical worm. I don't know what that is. And they invited the worm, and they said, worm, we're going to put the worm over here, and before you know it, the worm goes down and cuts the stone. So what did they do? They outlined the letters that made up the names of the Shvatim with ink, and then they brought the shamir, they put the shamir on, And they split open. And they split open. Says the Gemara, a dogma, for example, if you take a te'ena, a date, and you put it outside in this hot sun, what's going to happen after a while? What's going to happen? It's going to split open. So it splits open, there's a groove, but it's not missing anything. It's not like anything was taken away from it. So how did they get the names of the Shvatim to be Mekayim Pituchei Chosam and Milu Osam? They outlined the letters, they put the Shamir, and then it magically, it somehow miraculously split open, and that's how they got the names of the Shvatim on the stones of the Choshen and the Epho. Ad kan de Gemara. Now turn to page one. And now we're going to look at a Taz. The Taz on page one, who's the Taz? Who's the Taz? His mother didn't say to him, Tazala. Tazala, did you wash behind your ears last night? What was his name? Anybody know the name of the Taz? You don't know the name of the Taz. You do, you do. You're being bashful. Do you know when the Taz lived? Anybody know when the Taz lived? What? I can't hear you. He lived in the 17th century. Thank you. He lived in the 17th century. His name was Reb David Halevi. He lived in the 17th century. He died in 1667. We're going to look at four Achronim tonight, and I'm going to give you the dates of death of each one of them. Not so much that you should remember the date of death, it doesn't really matter, but I want to show you a historical progression from one generation to the next. The Taz lives through two of the major events of the 17th century in Eastern and Central European Jewish life. He lives through first the Khmelnytsky massacres of 1648-1649. He is a survivor of those massacres. And at the very end of his life, he lives through and is greatly influenced by Shabtai Tzvi and the Messianic Sabbatian movement. He dies 1 year after Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam. He dies in 1667. The Taz here is at the end of Simen Reish Ayin Aleph in Yeridaya. And the Shulchan Aruch here is talking about Sefer Torah, about the halachas of writing a Sefer Torah. And the Shulchan Aruch says that a Sefer Torah has to be written through ksiva. You have to write a Sefer Torah. We're very familiar with this. We have a cloth, and we have ink, and we have a cipher. And there's a whole procedure of how to write a Sefer Torah. Write a Sefer Torah by the time we come now to the middle of the 17th century, as opposed to probably printing a Sefer Torah, which would appear to be logical. Now comes the Taz. The Taz here is based on a Gemara Maseches Gittin Daf Chaf Amud Aleph that talks about a bill of divorce. The halacha is, the Torah tells us, V'chosav la Sefer Krisus. A bill of divorce has to be written. Says the Gemara in Gittin Chaf Amud Aleph, V'chosav v'lo v'chokak. Chakika is inscribing, ksiva is writing. And the Gemara gives us these two options, ksiva and chakika. When it comes to a get, ksiva is appropriate, it's a beferish pasuk, v'chosavla, as opposed to chakika. And that is in the background here in the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch about Sefer Torah. Says the Taz as follows, v'chakika. It's on the left-hand side of page one, and there's a little arrow in the margin once again. Hoil v'asa liyadon, now that we're talking about this, now that we're talking about the issue of writing and the issue of inscribing, ne'emar be'milsa, I want to say something. So now we're moving away from directly commenting on the text of the Shulchan Aruch, which is what the Taz is, and now we're talking about amahalchayin, and we're talking already about this issue, so I want to add something. Now I want to add something because something bothers me, because I've been hearing something that I don't agree with. Lefisha shamati omrim she'ein b'svarim hanitfasim kedusha kimo hanechtovim b'chsav. That printed books do not have the same level of sanctity as written books. L'may nafkemina, the level of kedusha for a printed book as opposed to a manuscript. L'may nafkemina, What would you say? How does the Kedusha of a written book express itself? Through the word, we call it Shemes. Shemes literally means Shemot, the names of Hashem, but it's come to be expanded rather liberally to have any Torah content that we don't want to throw it out. So I know that if it's a manuscript, I have to put it into, quote, Shemes. It's become already a noun, Shemes. So the question is, how do I dispose of a printed book? Does it have the same level of Kedusha that I have to worry about disposing of it appropriately and properly as does a written sefer or a cloth of tefillin or a cloth of a mezuzah or a piece of a sefer Torah? So the Taz says, I heard that a printed book does not have the same status as a book that's bichsav. And I hold that a printed book has a halacha of ksiva and not of chakika. I hold that a printed book, in fact, does have the same level of kedusha. And, in fact, I will prove it to you, a raya berura, a clear proof, and I'm going to prove it to you from the Gemara that we just learned. The Gemara that we just learned, namely, how did they get the letters of the Shvatim on the stones, is going to be for the Taz a raya, and he calls it actually a raya berura, that printing has a halacha of ksiva and not chakika. And he quotes the Gemara, and then he says as follows, Ve'im Isa, it's 3-4 lines before the lines get wide, Ve'im Isa, the Maisa hatfus have a chakika, if you're going to say that printing is not writing, that printing is inscribing, and since it's inscribing, it does not have the same level of kedusha as ksiva. Ve'im isa demaisa atfus have a chakika kosher. Mino lo dehaya yidei shamir shehu davar she'eino motzui. Why did the Gemara have to resolve the problem? What was the problem that the Gemara had? How did they get the names of the shvatim onto the stones? What did the Gemara say? I can't write it. I can't chisel it out. Oh, the halig is shamir. The shamir came. Why does the Gemara have to answer the Shamir? The Shamir is the Davar She'eino Matzui. What does the Davar She'eino Matzui mean? It's not easily accessible. Maybe there's a lineup for the Shamir. Maybe the Shamir is taking a nap. Who knows where the Shamir is? You have to go wait till you go find the Shamir. It's not available. So why does the Gemara have to say they went to the Shamir? Dilma hoya yedei atfus ubidiyo kidufus shalanu. I have another way out. And the other way out is they printed it. Why couldn't the Gemara have said that the way they got the names of the Shvatim on the stones is they printed it? Kidufus shalanu, like we have printing. Venimtza shaper miskayim pituche chosam. That's how you solve the problem. It is inscribed on. If it's chakika, it's inscribed. And nothing is missing. So why did they have to go crawl all the way to the Shamir? They had a much simpler suggestion, namely print it, just like we print. Elaboru, why didn't they print it? Because it shows you that printing does not have halach of chakika. Printing has halach of ksiva, and if printing has halach of ksiva, so they couldn't use it because it wouldn't have helped them. That's what the Taz says. Anybody want to react to this statement of the Taz? Yes?
They didn't have printing.
Pretty sharp. Pretty sharp. They didn't have printing. So what's the Taz saying? They could have printed it, and then since they didn't print it, it's a right that printing has a certain criteria. I'll tell you why they didn't print it. They didn't print it because they didn't have printing. But they had the Shamir. We know they had the Shamir. The Shamir is in Chazal. Chazal tell us they had a Shamir. The Taz says they could have printed it kidufus shalonu. Kidufus shalonu. When is the Fushalonu? What century did the Taz live? I just told you, in the 17th century. They had the Fushalonu in the 17th century. In the Mishkan, in the desert, they didn't have printing yet. That's the point that's being made on this side of the room. Yes? I can't hear you. Why? Okay. So you're saying they did have printing. Maybe they did have printing. Turn to page 3. I saw a hand over here. Turn to page 3. Zot the Helige Chavis Yoyer. But now on page 3. Who's the Chavis Yair? His mother didn't say to him, Chavis Yair, you're old. Actually, she did, because the second part of that is his name. Yeah, Moshe, what's his name? Rabbi Yair Chaim Bachrach. When did he die? 1702. Yeah, Yoni, 1702? Thank you. 1702. Rabbi Yair Chaim Bachrach died in 1702. He died 30 years, a little more than 30 years after the Taz. There's a tshuva in the Chavis Yair, Simen Kuf Pei Dalet, that deals with the issue of the sanctity of a printed book. And on the left-hand side, towards the bottom, he says that lahalacha, he agrees with the Taz, that printing has a halacha of ksiva and not chakika, but he disagrees with the proof of the Taz. Af ki la'anias daiti, it's about a third of the way from the bottom, ein hochachoso klum, mipnei shelo yodu lifnei shin shona me'inyan hatfus. He said they didn't know about printing. Printing was invented by Gutenberg in 1423 in Mainz, Johannes Gutenberg in Germany in the first half of the 15th century. That's when it was invented. Before then, they didn't have printing. They didn't have printing. How could the Taz say they should have printed it? That's what the Chavis Yair asks on the Taz. Now it gets more interesting. The bottom right, the Knesset Yecheskel. Shail Suchuvas Knesset Yecheskel, whose name was Rabbi Yecheskel Katzenellenbogen, who was the chief rabbi of the Triple Community of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. It was the death of Rabbi Yecheskel Katzenellenbogen in 1749 that opened up a position of chief rabbi now being available in that community of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. It was known as the Triple Community. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who was living in the community at that time, tried out for the job. His father was the chief rabbi, his grandfather was the chief rabbi, but he lost to the great Rabbi Yonason Eibschitz, and it didn't take long for the Emden-Eibschitz controversy to explode at the beginning of 1751. But all of this was precipitated by the Petira of the Knesset Yecheskel in 1749. Bottom right, page 3. And here I want to read inside. The Knesset Yecheskel quotes the Taz, and he quotes the rejection of the Chavis Yair. Uba'al Chavis Yair, the second of the medium lines. Uba'al Chavis Yair Kosav al Taz ki ra'ayoso nidches behiyos hadfus Chadosha Mikorov Ba'u. It only started in the second century of the sixth millennium. It only started in the 1440s. Ubemechilas Kevodo, says the Knesset Yecheskel about the Chavis Yair. How do you translate Ubemechilas Kevodo? With all due respect. If somebody says to you, with all due respect, what's going to follow? Disrespect. I mean, or tremendous opposition. So you want to say it nicely, with all due respect, you better get ready and, you know, put on your raincoat with an umbrella because it's coming. Ube mechilas kavoda. How dare the Chavis Yair say that they didn't have printing? And that's why the Taz is wrong. The reason why they didn't use printing is because they didn't have printing. Ubemechilas kavodo. V'chi Moshe Rabbeinu olav hashalom, mem resh ayin hey, asher diber ponim el ponim. Are you trying to tell me that Moshe Rabbeinu, who spoke to God face to face, u'shlomo, asher olav ne'emar v'yechka mikol ha'oda, or Shlomo HaMelech, about whom the Bible tells us that he was the smartest man who ever lived. Lo yodu lahamtzi chochmas hatfus. You trying to tell me that Moshe and Shlomo couldn't invent printing? Ad shekam chocham umos haolam? But some guy had to invent printing? Some guy had to invent printing? You're trying to tell me that Gutenberg was smarter than Moshe Rabbeinu and Shlomo HaMelech? How could you say such a thing? Of course they could have invented printing. If it would have helped them, they would have invented printing. Why did they not invent printing? The Taz says, because it wouldn't have mattered. Because printing has a halach of ksiva and not chakika. So even if they printed it on, it still wouldn't be good because it has to be pituchei chosam. We're back to the raya of the Taz. What does the Chavos Yoreh say? They didn't have printing? Excuse me. That's disrespectful of the great Moshe and disrespectful of the great Shlomo. I don't mean they didn't have printing. Was some guy had to figure out printing? They couldn't. They were the smartest, the greatest, the highest, the most exalted, the most prophetic human beings ever on the face of this earth. Of course they could have invented printing. Elovada Elohoya Tzorach Lehu, says Rabbi Katz in Ellenbog. They didn't need printing. It wouldn't have mattered. Gedvarim Shebal Peh Lohoya Rishoyin Lichtov. Things that had to be oral had to be oral. Right, the Torah Shebichsav is written, and Torah Shebal Peh by definition means it's not written. Udvarim Shebichsav Hoya Tzorach Dafka Al Klaf Uchsav Kisefa Torah. So if it had to be written, it had to be written. If it couldn't be written, it couldn't be written. Printing isn't going to matter. Printing isn't going to matter. That's why they didn't have printing. So what do we have now? We have three interpretations. The Taz brings a raya from the Gemara that printing has a halacha of ksiva, because if it was chakika, they would have used it. The Chavos Yoreh says, what are you talking about? They didn't use it because they didn't have it. And the Knesset Yecheskel says, of course they could have used it. And if it would have worked, they would have had it. Because nobody was greater than Moshe or Shlomo. Which brings me to the final source, and that is the Maharatz Chayis. You know what I'm going to say? What am I going to say? His mother didn't say Maharatz Chayis, or what was his name? The Maharatz Chayis? Moshe? Tuvi. Ritzvi Hirsch Chayis. Ritzvi Hirsch Chayis died in 1855. Ritzvi Hirsch Chayis, so you should know who he is, he's in the back of the Gemara. Avayla Fine Yeet and made it into the back of the Gemara. He's actually the subject of a fascinating doctoral dissertation that you should know about. He's a subject of a doctoral dissertation, Columbia University, by Bruria Huttner David. Rav Huttner, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, had one child, had one daughter. Bruria was married to Rabbi Yonason David. She runs Beis Yaakov in Yerushalayim now for many, many, many years. So she has a PhD from Columbia University in Jewish history, and she wrote her dissertation on the Maharatz Chayis. And even though it's over 40 years old, it still is the final word ad hayom hazeh on this subject. Anybody who wants to know anything about the Maharatz Chayis has to go to Bruria Huttner David's dissertation, Columbia University. Maharatz Chayis is already living in a different world. Maharatz Chayis was a Galatiana, and the Maharatz Chayis was a little bit more open. His father taught him different languages. His father was a businessman. He taught him French, and he taught him German, and he taught him Italian, and he knew other secular subjects, while at the same time being a rock-solid Talmud Chacham, Haraya. He's in the back of the Gemara. The Maharatz Chayis has Chuvis, Shailosu Chuvis Maharatz Chayis. We have Kol Kisvei Maharatz Chayis in the library and in the Beis Medrash in two volumes. One of them has a number of tshuvas, different chalakim and tshuvas of the Maharatz Chayis. In Siman Yud Aleph, he takes on the Knesset Yecheskel, who took on the Chavos Yoreh for taking on the Taz. And this will conclude this discussion. The Ode, bottom left, page 3. The Ode, Kvodo Hagodol Shel Harav Knesset Yecheskel B'Mekomo Munach. How do you translate Kvodo B'Mekomo Munach? Sounds like B'Mechilas Kvodo, with all due respect. Kvodo Hagodol, Kvodo B'Mekomo Kavod, but B'Mekomo Munach. We're gonna put it in the corner for now. Udvarov Bazeh, Einam Rachman Hamatmihin. What he said is wondrous. You remember, what did he say? What did the Knesset Yecheskel say? That of course Moshe and Shlomo could have invented printing. You don't need a guy to invent printing. They were the greatest and the smartest and the highest and the most exalted. This is not a way how to develop a halachic position. Now listen to the Maratz Chayes. It's actually fascinating. The MS, he says, you're right. Ki Moshe Rabbeinu lo kam kamoso b'nevuah, u'shlomo lo kam kamoso b'chachma. You're right. Nobody was a greater prophet than Moshe Rabbeinu, and nobody was smarter than Shlomo. No question about it. Of course, it's a beferish pasuk that Moshe spoke to Hashem panim el panim, and Shlomo HaMelech was the greatest chacham mikol adam. That's lesman de palig. That is absolutely non-negotiable, 100%. Ulam, however, that doesn't mean that they could have invented printing. Ulam Hashem yisbarach hebid v'ra'a me'reishis. God looked at things from the beginning. Ugevulos cholak l'chol hazmanim v'hadoros l'hashlomas hachachmos. And he set up certain boundaries, and this is my language, to the unfolding of human knowledge. There's certain generations and certain centuries where knowledge unfolds, and God decided from the beginning how he was going to unfold and open up and show the development of human knowledge from one tekufa, from one time to another. Hashem yisbarach hebid v'ra'a me'reishis u'gevulos cholak l'chol hazmanim v'hadoros l'hashlomas hachochmos v'lo kol ha'ito shavos b'zeh. Not all centuries are the same. Itim choshin ve'en chazon hachochmo nifratz. There are times when things go very slowly, where there are no real technological breakthroughs. So from the year, 400 to 1400, it's the same behemoth, and it's the same plow, and it's the same farmer. Isn't that much going on? And ve'itim memalulim besvuna, ubalei hachochma v'askula merubin. And then there are times when there's a lot going on. So for the last 10 years, the list is an explosion with all the iPhones and the iPods and the iThis and all the different ways of communicating. I regretfully live in the dark ages because I have a BlackBerry. So I have a grandson who's 4 years old who says, Zadie, I want to play with your phone. And he takes my phone and he goes like this, and nothing happens. He says, Zadie, it's broken. Zadie, it's broken. Nothing happens. Because I'm living in the dark ages, because this is 7 minutes old, and the thing that goes like this is 3 minutes old. So there are some generations when nothing moves, and then there are some generations when it's just an explosion. And it's all worked out, Meirosh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from the beginning of time, figured out how he's going to unwind and unfold human knowledge. Ve'en lo chadavar she'en lo zman u'makom. Everything has its place. God sees everything from the beginning. What's the point of Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayes? That Moshe and Shlomo could not possibly have invented printing, because all of the items in place that led to the invention of printing had not yet been unfolded. And it's not a chisorin in the godless of Moshe and Shlomo if they didn't invent printing, or could not have invented printing. So therefore they could not have invented printing. If they could not have invented printing, so the Chavos Yoreh is right in rejecting the Taz, that the reason why they didn't have printing to put the names of the Shvatim onto the stones is because they didn't have printing. So the Taz wants to bring a Raya. But why didn't they use printing? Is a Raya printing this Ksiva? No, that's not why. So the Chavos Yoreh says they didn't have printing. What did the Knesset Yecheskel say? How dare you say that? You're undermining the godless of Moshe and Shlomo. Of course they could have invented printing. Says the Maratz Chayes, it's not a chisorim in their greatness if they could not possibly have invented printing. I gave a piece of this talk a while ago, and there was somebody sitting there. Turn to page 5. There was somebody sitting there who has a blog on the Atlantic Monthly. You know, there's a magazine, The Atlantic, and they have a website. And this fellow, Alan Jacobs, who's a professor of English in a small college in the South, has a blog on the Atlantic website. And he was sitting there, and he is not a Jewish fellow, and he had trouble with all the Taz and the Knesset Yecheskel. So he was sitting next to somebody who was translating for him, and whenever I quoted a Gemara, he found it online, very adept in using the internet technology. So he summarized this shiur, and I just want to read to you one paragraph, because I thought he really captured what it was that I was trying to convey. We're now on the last page. Rabbi Schachter took us on a virtuosic whirlwind tour of these texts, demonstrating that Karo, the Taz, and their successors became consumed by the question of what we might call the conditions of technological possibility. Why was there no printing press in the time of the patriarchs or of the sages of the Mishnah? Were these not great and wise men, men who talked with God, exclamation point, who could have invented the printing press had they thought it appropriate to do so, or had God so instructed them? And was not their failure to do so an indication that the printing press is to be shunned? I didn't say that. I don't think it's a riot that it was to be shunned. It means that it was not halachically relevant. Some thought so, but other replies, no, not at all. The fact that these men were great sages who knew God did not mean that they could overleap the state of their own age. I think it's written very interesting, very sharply. Technology develops incrementally in any given culture, and even the wisest men of God have no power to escape those conditions. Technological history and sacred history connect and sometimes overlap, but are essentially distinct. And so what I would like to leave you with is this question. So we have on the one hand a Knesset Yecheskel who says, Chas v'shalom, Rachmana Litzlan, what kind of mechutz of you? How could you say that Moshe and Shlomo could not have invented printing? After all, they were the greatest of the great. And then you have on the other side the Maariv Chayes, who says, it's not a chisaron in their greatness if they just conceivably could not possibly have invented printing. The title of the talk is, Did Moshe Rabbeinu Know Everything? I think that's the title of the talk. Did Moshe Rabbeinu Know Everything? Printing progress in the unfolding of human knowledge. So do you think Moshe Rabbeinu knew everything, or did he not know everything? I want to leave you with this thought. On page 4, and this is for you to take a look at, is the one source that I found to come full circle to the beginning of my talk, where printing is an exact analog to the internet. In one tshuva of the Chassam Sofer, which I Xerox for you on page 4, and if you're interested, you'll take it home and you'll read it, and if you ever write something on the ethic of the internet, this is going to be your main source. The Chassam Sofer talks about the blessings of printing and the challenges of printing. The Chassam Sofer talks about the challenges of printing, number one, quality control. If you write something and you want to copy it, it takes a long time to copy it. People are only going to invest in copying something that is worthwhile. To print something, you just put it together, you have your plates, and you print. There's no quality control. Second issue, and this is something that some of you have regretfully experienced firsthand when it comes to the internet, is that if you put something out there, it's permanent. It's permanent. If you put it on Facebook, if you send somebody an email, it's permanent. You can't call it back. And it can come back sometimes to haunt you. You can post things that in the fit of your youthful sense of invincibility, you think is perfectly fine. And then somebody's gonna come take a look at it, whether it's a prospective spouse, whether it's a prospective employer, and you will have just royally shot yourself in the head because you didn't have seichel. When you put something out there in a fit of youthful exuberance that you thought isn't going to damage you, it's permanent. And you need to be really careful. Printing is permanent. That's what the Chassam Sofer says. Issue number one is quality control. Issue number two is permanence. Issue number three is what he calls heresy. You could print whatever you want. It's not just the din and quality control that it's lousy, but it's actually dangerous. It's actually heretical. And part of what we have on the internet is exposure to material that's not good for us, that is dangerous for us, that is spiritually, morally corrosive for us. So you can draw a direct line, and this tshuva is the source to draw a direct line from the issues of printing to the issues of the internet. And the question is, what is the source of the power of printing? What is the halachic status of printing? And what about Moshe Rabbeinu? All of this, in order to spend a few minutes to remember Gilad Schwartz, and in a sense there's a lack of connection here, because Rachmana Litzlan, when a child, a young child dies, it is almost in a sense the opposite of the notion of progress, the notion of unfolding of knowledge. The whole shiur and the direction of the shiur, certainly the Maariv Chayis, focuses on future, focuses on this generation knows this and that generation knows that, and there's a notion of future. In the case of a tragedy of the loss of a child, the future is very complicated. And maybe that's the bracha that I want to give to Gilad's family, is to somehow, over the course of time, constantly remembering him as you do, and keeping him at the forefront of your consciousness as you do, to be able somehow to gain the strength and the capacity to take his memory with you into the future, and to be able to put one foot in front of another foot, and to be able to yourselves and all of us, and thanks to Adam, to continue the values and the memory that Gilad was and left us, to continue to bring that into the future. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give you the capacity to look to a future and to bring this great gift that you had with you into the future for yourselves and to the future for your family. Gilad Hillel ben Eliyahu Mordechai Ubracha Miril Tehei Nishmaso Tzrura B'Tzurorach.
Thank you, Rabbi Schachter. At this point, we are going to hear a few words from Mrs. Michelle Schwartz, Gilad's mother.
I have to say that Gilad may have said to you, Rav Schachter, in all due respect, and then had a conversation with you, but we don't know about that. My voice sounds a lot worse than it feels, so just bear with me. I wanted to welcome everybody here, and thank you for coming tonight. It's very special to see so many people turn out for our son, to honor our son. And my husband Eddie and I extend our deep gratitude to Rav Schachter for once again gracing us with his presence and his words in memory of our dear son, Gilad Schwartz. And of course, we always welcome Rabbi Blau. Back in the day, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, my husband was a student here at YU, so we're familiar with the face. And I think Gilad would have appreciated this topic, because he was somebody that was intrigued by knowledge, by human knowledge and by Torah. And it was actually one of the things he really was grappling with at the end, trying to read a lot of philosophy books and trying to really understand what the world was about. As Rav Schachter said, this is the third time, the third year, we've gathered together at a shiur at Yeshiva University to remember Gilad Schwartz with Torah, with memories, and with friends who care. From deep in my heart, I thank Adam Newman for coordinating this evening as a way to honor his childhood friend. I'd sort of say it's a chazaka, but everybody's graduating, so I don't know that, but still, it's very nice that we were able to do this for him. For those of you who never knew Gilad, I'd like to share some words about him. Gilad was our third child. Our oldest is here tonight. Gilad was a beautiful, caring, warm, and kind person. He was definitely funny. He was definitely smart. He was witty. He had a sense of humor, took after my father-in-law. He really could deliver a joke really well. He had a gift for playing guitar. Music was something that really coursed through his soul. It was also one of the last things he was able to do in his life was play some music with his brother. He passed away at age 19, right when he was on the cusp of adulthood, on the brink of beginning his life. He had just finished his first semester of college at University of Maryland. He was about to pursue his passions and discover his identity and find a chosen ambition. But unfortunately, cancer changed all of that. It changed high school for him. It cut short his college career. It altered his future. It took away his future. And Adam, now you, along with your peers, not everybody in this room, but a lot of your peers will be graduating in a few short weeks. I know you have to get through finals first. After completing the required course of college study, you are the next group of young men and women advancing to the next schlav, the next phase of your lives. And upon graduation, each of you will find your own path. For some, it will be graduate school to continue your education and train in a particular field or specialty. Others will be joining the workforce, and along the way, you will each find your own unique niche, your contribution to society. And then, as life evolves and goals change, your path may shift this way or that, but hopefully, you will each find something that will prove rewarding to your life. Rav Schechter spoke about Moshe, a strong and charismatic character, and probably one of the greatest leaders of the Jewish people. When I wrote this, I didn't know what Rav Schechter would be talking about, but I liked that idea that he would be speaking about human knowledge, because that is something that Gilad grappled with. And the pursuit of knowledge is something that many of us spend our life doing. Leadership was Moshe's career, and some of you may pursue leadership or management or activism. But as much as each community and business needs leaders, every group also needs strong, supportive, active individuals contributing their own share, moving their own cog in the wheel. And remember that whatever position you take, whatever career path you choose, all have value and all are significant in some way. As time goes on, I find that it has become more difficult to talk about Gilad. Not because I don't want to, but simply because he's not on people's minds as much. Of course, as his mother, I think about him throughout the day, multiple times during the day, and so does my husband, Eddie. But I cannot expect that from others. The crisis mode of illness has passed, the initial grief period is long gone, and now as we approach 3 years this summer, we have somewhat plateaued in a sense. We struggle, we try to find the balance between keeping Gilad alive in our hearts, keeping the memory of his essence in our minds, and weaving him into our lives in a comfortable way. But it's not easy. Gilad never had the opportunity to finish college and not follow any of the paths any of you may choose. But what I would sincerely and deeply appreciate is that if you could think of Gilad as you move forward in your lives. In previous years, I asked you to take Gilad along with you, to remember his passions, merge his your footsteps with his so that he won't be forgotten. At this stage of your life, as you're starting to move on, I'm asking you to appreciate the opportunities that will present themselves to you in the form of jobs or education. It may be frustrating for you to send out endless resumes, go on nonstop interviews, or not be interviewed at all. It may be exasperating for you to take the MCATs, the LSATs, GREs, apply to multiple schools, and wait anxiously for your acceptance. It may be a challenge for you to combine Torah and work and find time for both. Now, Gilad may also have been annoyed at some of these real-life issues and challenges, but I know that he would have loved to have these options, and he would have been eager to move forward with his future. I don't expect you to compare your life with someone who's no longer alive, but by thinking about Gilad as you forge ahead, I hope that his spirit and his character can inspire you, and that maybe you will gain a little more perspective and not get as irritated and aggravated as you otherwise would as your lives unfold. I've said this before, Gilad had no children to carry on his ambitions and passions, so you are his legacy. Please continue to remember him, to remember his remarkable personality, his tenacity and his drive, his interests and aspirations. As you meet with success in your career and educational paths, take him along with you. I know that he will not be forgotten if you, his friends and peers, carry him with you as you move to the next stage of your lives. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, again, for coming tonight. If there's interest in Mara, if you could have that. If there's not, there's not.